From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. How best to describe my guest, Charles Imbolo? How about just reading from the back of his memoir, Fire Shut Up in My Bones? Charles Imbolo has been a columnist for the New York Times since 2008, a CNN commentator, has appeared on MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, the BBC, Al Jazeera, and HBO. He also got his start at the Times in a pretty unusual way. In effect, he was a visual journalist, were you not?
Yes, that's correct.
There's a meticulousness you have with images and words. I know that you're somebody who does not ever suffer the first choice that you make. So I wonder how tough it was to write a memoir when you had to look over the way you were writing it and these things that were so incredibly personal to you.
Well, I mean, I think once you decide to write memoir, if you're in for an inch, you're in for a mile. You can't half write a memoir. So once I had decided that that was what I was going to do, then it became just the literary exercise. Can I do it? Because in a way, this is about the South. This is about the poor South. There are no magnificent monuments. There's no amazing architecture in my tiny town. So how do I capture and transport readers to this place and make them see it as I saw it and make them care about it and make it beautiful and tragic in the way that I experienced it? And so then it became just a literary exercise. And in a way, kind of the visual training kicked in, because, being able to see it as if I were painting it and then use words instead of colors and brushes to do that became the exercise.
Because what I found so much in the reading of the book is it's really, in so many ways, about becoming a man, about living
yes.
through boyhood, isn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, absolutely. It is the transformation. It is coming into self. It is navigating all of the landmines that litter the masculine experience in America.
The black masculine experience in America.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I thought about James Baldwin, particularly The Fire Next Time, as I was reading, just because that book is also about the violence of change in childhood.
Right.
And this is really, every month of your life is rocked with violent change. And I just wonder about the emotional consequence of revisiting that.
Well, I mean, part of that, I had to do some kind of emotional archaeology to get there, because this was a part of my life that the book is ostensibly ends 20 some plus years ago. And so I had to go back into those experiences. And a lot of that was literally visiting places. The house where I grew up was still standing at the time. It's no longer there now. But I would go into the room where I used to sleep and just sit there on the floor. The curtains were still there. It was still painted the same color. I had to try to transport myself back to that place to be that boy, to remember the feelings as I had experienced them in that moment, and to get the granularity and the grittiness of it. The world that I was in was so small that that was possible. There's a certain beauty in that exercise for me.
Because, again, getting back to the violence, mm-hmm. The sheer sort of terror, mm-hmm. and the havoc, I should say, that change wreaked upon your life. What was it like revisiting all those things?
I have a little bit of detachment because it's so long ago, which was great. I don't think that I could have written it as soon as it was finished. It took me being in my 40s and having children of my own who I could see grow up and see how small they were. I mean, there's something about memories that they stay with you and you keep reliving them, particularly traumatic memories, and you process them through the adult mind in the moment that you're revisiting it. But with my own children, I could see how at 7 years old, you don't know anything. There's not a lot. You can't necessarily say I made the wrong choice or whatever, because you don't even know what choices are. You're so small in that world. So, going back, and it wasn't traumatic anyway, in a way, but it was revelatory. I don't think you really know your life until you write your life. I didn't know mine fully.
You really think that?
I don't believe that. I don't believe that I knew it. I think that I knew it, as vapor, as,
kind of
ephemeral memories.
As somebody who's constantly writing about life and its shifts and just reading a bunch of stuff, you're often writing about impact.
Right.
I mean, that's something that appeals to you right. as a journalist, isn't it? I mean, the idea of the impact and the collateral damage of that impact.
Right. The effect and function of things on the world, and particularly on people who are vulnerable. And that grows very much out of my own experience. What was affecting me and when I was most vulnerable, and the idea that to some degree I had choices that I could make and how to figure out how to deal with those things, but I didn't have choices in whether or not they were going to happen. And I just had to deal with what was happening, what was coming into my world, and try to survive it. And, you know, Baldwin once said, no one knows how truly expensive it is. You don't know how truly expensive it is to be poor unless you've been poor. I'm paraphrasing. I'm screwing up. Father Baldwin, please forgive me right now. I'm screwing up his quote. but poverty extracts a tremendous payment on people who are poor, and you just have to deal with what's happening in your life. And I think I try to write about that.
It's the truth. My guest who's attempting to go tell on the mountain is Charles M. Blow. His terrific first memoir is Fire Sharp in My Bones. He's, of course, a columnist at the New York Times. Talk about where you grew up, where you were born.
Right. So I grew up in a small town. It's called Gibbsland, Louisiana. It was quite literally Gibbs land because it was the former plantation of a man named Gibbs. It was a segregated town. Most of the white people in town lived on either side of Main Street, which is essentially on the east side of town. Most black people lived on the west side of town. We lived on the blackest of black side of town because we lived on the last street on the west side of town. Louisiana schools had just been forced to integrate the year I was born. And people didn't take that well, so virtually all of the white children were taken out of school. So I never grew up around white kids. I didn't even know that they lived in our town because you never saw them. They went to special academies that popped up around Louisiana when it was forced to integrate. And it was a lot of vigilante justice in town because there wasn't, you know, it's a small town. There's one police officer.
And not really even a jail, as you say.
There was no jail. If you went to jail, you went to the county jail. So, you know, people took justice into their own hands quite often.
And there's that sense of, one of the things, the word you use a number of times in the book, and I want you to talk about this because it's a concept that comes up in your work as well a lot, is honor.
Yes. Yes. People, you know, and which was always strange to me when I would hear about violent, you know, kind of inner city violence, where it seemed kind of arbitrary, or it was kind of gang related,
or indiscriminate,
with malicious intent, or you know, for malicious reasons, or for nefarious reasons, you know, there was drugs involved. I saw a lot of violence, but it was never for that. The community almost had to approve the violence. This was because someone had cheated and they were being dishonorable, or someone had tried to steal something, or something. You know, that if there was honor at the base of it, people felt like they had the right to take it into their own hands.
And I just, because I found it's, as somebody with family from the South, I spent a lot of time in Hattiesburg, Mississippi as a boy. I spent summers there. And you talk about going to live with relatives,
yes.
Sometimes in your own life.
Yes.
And there's that sort of thing of when you go to the South, there's a kind of an Old Testament justice.
Yes.
And that's very much subtextual in this.
Absolutely.
You don't really mention it much, but
right.
It had to be a big part of that life of yours.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the kind of Old Testament, the biblical overlay is woven throughout the book. The title of the book is from Jeremiah.
Yeah. Talk about why you chose the title.
Well, Jeremiah, you know, he's a fascinating prophet. the crying prophet, some people call him.
The weeping prophet, they used to call him down south.
The weeping prophet. This is Jeremiah 20:9 where this title comes from. And he's tired, he's exhausted, he doesn't want to preach anymore, no one's receiving it well, and he doesn't want to do it. And he says, I don't want to talk anymore, I don't want to preach. And then he says, but when I try to hold it in, it feels like a fire shut up in my bones. And I always thought that that was a beautiful turn of phrase. And I don't know if we think the original author of Jeremiah's, the book of Jeremiah, or King James's translators or whomever, but somebody, that is a beautiful turn of phrase. And I always love that. And I thought it was apropos for this text.
I thought so too, because I was thinking back to the King James Bible, and that sense of eruption is very much a part of this. I mean, things erupt in this book, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Over and over again. And there is no end to the calamity, that you have to learn to live with constant calamity, and that this is what this sort of survival means. Learning to not just deal with one issue, one problem, one thing that happens that is psychically damaging, but to realize that psychic damage is going to be a constant for you. And how will you deal with constant assault on your spirit? And that is what becomes the kind of narrative thread for the book. It's not just boy to man coming of age. It is coming of age in constant crisis. And knowing that you can build a set of skills, survival skills, that will allow you to survive that, to contextualize it, to build safe spaces, quiet spaces around you, to find the eye of the storm, because you will always be in a storm, and that those survival skills can actually benefit you later in life.
Not only that, but that sense of being around people who, in the case of your mom, for example, was constantly managing crisis.
Absolutely. And, you know, she's not a perfect person, but neither am I. I see her as, you know, I think before I wrote the book, there is a kind of a hero status, angelic hero status that I have bestowed on her. And I saw her in the writing as much more human.
But also that sense of meeting out a kind of an Old Testament judgment.
Yes,
I mean, that
sense of absolute
right and wrong that a child would say.
Yes, yes. And she's very much into the honor part of things, and does not take disrespect well at all, and can, you know, get really, really, really upset by it and act in some ways irrationally in the face of it. But I also saw in her just a tremendous resilience. Just as hard as I had it, she had it. I can't even imagine how she did it some days. When I was a little kid, I didn't even think she slept. She was awake when I went to sleep. She was awake when I woke up. We didn't have a lot of clothes. She would buy us at the beginning of the school year, she would buy like 5 sets of underwear and maybe 5 sets of clothes. Maybe you had 5 different tops and bottoms, and maybe not. But we were always clean. She was always washing. She's always ironing. She's always making her own clothes, because if she bought them for us, she wouldn't have money left over to buy them for herself. In addition to that, we're farming. She's putting away vegetables for the winter months. I look at her and I'm thinking, where does that come from? And I try to summon that strength and summon that resolve whenever I feel sorry for myself and say, I have seen someone who could have given up, who could have felt sorry for herself, who could have said, maybe I won't make it, who said, there is no way on earth that I will not make it. And that was my mom.
We should take a break. My guest, who I know has more than 5 pieces of shirts because I've gone shopping with him before, is Charles M. Blow, New York Times columnist. His terrific memoir is Fire Shut Up My Bones. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
I'm Jenny Rattlett, producer of The Treatment. If you like our show, you might also like The Business, KCRW's show about the business of show business, hosted by Kim Masters of The Hollywood Reporter. Find it on iTunes or on KCRW's smartphone apps.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. We just went shopping at Charles M. Blow.
I can't afford to shop at the places that you shop at.
Anyway, I don't work for the New York Times anymore. He's there. He's a columnist. His terrific memoir, his first, is Fire Shut Up In My Bones. Here's the thing I want to ask you about, too, because there's an incident in the book where there's an accident on the freeway and there are a bunch of cows that have been.
Yes.
And people go, and including your mom, the kind of things that you normally do during daylight. And southern nighttime is a different thing, but there, you write about waking up in the car,
right,
in the front seat of the car, and seeing a cow's carcass that's been opened.
Right.
And so much of the book is about that kind of thing when you wake up as a kid and the world has completely changed.
Right. It's that, and it is about the mystery of night and darkness, that my world spins around these nighttime episodes.
And the world becomes a different, a place where there is no justice.
Yes.
Nighttime is a place where justice goes away.
All the rules seem to, in my view as a child, seem to melt into the shadows. And
I wonder where that idea of using that, because daylight is a time where you can smell things. I mean, you don't even talk. You don't even really.
I talk about the sweet gum trees and the honeysuckle scented breezes and to me the daylight was beautiful, and skipping through the street with my uncle and going to the local candy lady and getting snow cones and sugar cookies, and daytime was my safe time. I was afraid of the night because everything seemed to change at night. At night was when I would think most about my kind of sexual complicated nature. And so all of it, everything seemed to happen at night. And so it was always strange for me to get comfortable in the darkness.
In line of that, I mean, there's a section near the end of the book called The Lie Detector, mm-hmm, where it's a time where I think for dramatic purposes, it works so well because it's a time where you're forced to come to some sort of clarification about yourself.
Sure.
So if you can read that section of the book, please.
Sure. I don't remember exactly how the CIA came to recruit me or precisely when, but they did, around the time that I resigned as fraternity president. I was being chosen again. What I do recall is that the CIA came to our school each year to recruit. And once an agent came to speak to a history class I was taking. When he was done, he was peppered with silly questions, like the one from the boy who asked, "Did you guys kill JFK?" The agent responded with his own brand of deadpan humor, "I can't tell you, because if I did, I'd have to kill you." I remember thinking that an internship with the CIA would look good on the resume of someone who still wanted to become a lawyer before becoming a politician. They wanted me. They seemed to delight in the notion of a smart boy from the middle of nowhere, and I wanted them. I was soon summoned to CIA headquarters for a final round of interviews and tests. My only fear was that Uncle Henry's time at Leavenworth would show up on one of the background checks and disqualify me. The plane I took to Washington was only the second one I had been on after my first to the International Science Fair. That weekend at the CIA was a blur of serious faces and conservative suits. The prospective interns sat through meetings in which square-jawed men gave sophoric speeches about what the agency stood for and what our likely jobs would be, analyzing a country or region and writing a report on it. We were interviewed and given basic physicals. Our sight and hearing were checked, mine for the first time. I was sailing through it all, sure that the internship was a lock, until it was time to take the lie detector test. I sat in the chair, and the agent asked me a round of questions to calibrate the machine, simple questions like what was my name. Then he began with the real ones. They were things like, "Have you ever cheated on an exam?" All seemed to be going well until two questions came, the second more stressful than the first. The first was, "Have you ever used drugs?" I answered no, which was true, but I could hear the needle of the machine scratching "lie" on the paper and could hear the man's papers rustle as he wrote. How could this be, I thought. Was it the guilt of sharing the weed-filled locker with Russell and Alfonso in high school? Was it my belief that I'd likely gotten a contact high from the weed my fraternity brothers smoked? What had caused the anxiety at the asking of that question? And before I could truly recover, the second question came. Have you ever had sex with a man?
And that's a fascinating trigger, too. By the way, it's The Treatment. My guest is Charles M. Blow, the New York Times columnist. His wonderful memoir is Fire Shut Up in My Bones. That deals with something you'd lead us through about the first third of the book,
yes,
when you're taken advantage of.
Yes.
And it brought to mind so many questions. I mean, for the first time, you wonder about the relationship you have with your mother, which felt to you like it was deep in the bones, telepathic,
right,
when after you had been violated, your space had been violated, you wonder why your mother couldn't possibly know about it.
Right, because
this.
I think you, as small children, you think that they know everything. Your parents, they can read what you're thinking with before you say it. And I literally thought that maybe, you know, that she could read, should be able to read the look on my face, because I couldn't bring myself to say what had happened. But of course, that's not the way it works. Your parents can't read your mind.
And you also, in that way that when you're a child and you don't really have a sense that everything is not your fault,
right,
you were going over all these things in your mind. And also, before you had a chance to even deal with your own sexuality, it forced,
right,
you to ask some questions of yourself.
Right. You very often blame yourself. That's a very routine thing that many child sex abuse survivors do. And depending on how young you are, in particular, I'm 7 years old at this point, you're a pre-sexual being. You don't even know what sex is. You don't, you know kissing, you know, kids, sometimes people hold hands.
Because you write about a section earlier in the book where you're in bed with your mother and your father and,
right,
they begin to
right,
have sex.
Right, and you don't know what's happening. You know, you just don't know. And so what can happen, I think, is that these young children like me can braid together kind of attraction and abuse, that they become one and the same. And it can take the rest of your life to unbraid those two things and realize that they are separate, that this person has did a horrible thing and has very little to do with who you would have been attracted to anyway, that you are most likely predetermined or at least predisposed to like whoever you were going to like. And they don't have that much power and agency over your life to determine who you will like later. That does not mean that there won't be effects. Like, it can affect your ability to trust. It can affect the way in which you experience intimacy. It can affect, you know, there are a lot of effects, but it cannot change you fundamentally from who you were always going to be.
And it's also, again, I asked about Baldwin because it's so much a Baldwin too. I mean, that sort of moment where this, again, that kind of the complete sort of altering moments of change,
right,
and those ways that you, when that happens at a very young age, you really can't get your mind around it because you,
right,
can't source it.
Right.
And as you get older and these things are still happening, you finally have to ask yourself what your place is in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And accept that place. And not as some sort of woeful acquiescence of an acceptance, but a joyful embrace of an acceptance. And those are different sorts of things. That you have a right, no, in fact, you have a moral obligation to yourself to truly love yourself as you are. And you cannot abdicate that moral obligation, because all other love that ever comes to you, for it to be fully appreciated, has to start with your own ability to love yourself.
I think part of this, too, gets also back to the example of industry that we talked about in the first half, where there really isn't, for most Black people who come up in the South, and we hear so much about dealing with, I mean, the violence that we've been subjected to as a people here.
Right.
The fact is that, for the most part, there is not a sense of victimization. And it's often recounting these stories,
right,
is mistaken for that, isn't it?
Right, exactly. And that what I'm trying to paint here is also the beauty of maturation, that when you mature in yourself and become comfortable with yourself, you're able to love yourself and you're able to forgive people and empathize with people and allow them to love you in the way that they are capable of and not require only the love as you imagine it should be. And there's a freedom in that. And there's also just the kind of historical legacy of violence against black and brown bodies in America that you have to overcome. You know, Toni Morrison in Beloved has Baby Shug Holy in the forest, and she's saying, hug yourself and laugh and cry. And I think that scene is lost on people because it is just saying, you have a right and a responsibility to love this body that people hate and to experience it wholly and laugh and love and caress the neck that some people want to see in a noose. And there's I've always been moved by that scene because it's been so formative for me, and even in writing this book and learning to just hold myself and love this body and know that it is worthy, and no matter how much violence, psychic, physically, sexual, might have been visited on it, it is still mine and worthy of my love.
This is one, before we go to what I wanted to really get to, is you can chart over the course of your life, as if you're a person of color, you can, the way that skin tones come in and out of fashion.
Yes.
And you were chocolate as a boy.
I was a little brown boy.
You were a little brown boy. It was chocolate, which yes, was chocolate. Doted upon. Then you said you weren't classically handsome, but then you came to that period where every person of a darker hue was looked upon as being black and beautiful. And then in the 90s, and I think this is something we don't see very often written about in popular culture, certainly not in the book that's going to go into the mainstream, about that shift.
Yes. Yes.
That when it was more important to be light-skinned and have that wet hair we said all
right. And if you look through the history of black pop culture, that moment had existed before.
Basically, until the 60s.
Yes, yes. And in the 60s, you could have an afro. You could have natural hair, and being dark-skinned was, you know, black is beautiful and black power. And, you know, and I'm born in the 70s, so I'm coming right after all that, and everybody wears an afro. I wore an afro forever. No one would ever imagine that, because I don't shave my head now. And all of a sudden, that shifts, and all of the singers change from being these kind of dark-skinned soul singers to very fair-skinned men, and even men who were dark, Michael Jackson, become light-skinned men.
Became white, as you say in the book.
Yes. So it was shocking for me to then go from not thinking about skin color to then being acutely aware that I was not the vogue skin color of the moment. And that reoriented kind of social standing.
We're out of time. I'm really sorry. This is such a great book, Charles. I can't thank you enough for doing
this. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. My guest, he's still in vogue, is Charles M. Blow. His first memoir is Fire Shut Up in My Bones. Our recording engineer at NPR West is Leo DeLaglia. The show is mixed by Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Rattlett. I'm going to go buy some clothes and rest in. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.